Well, they had more trouble learning the language because they were together all the time.
So they were together, sure.
Yeah.
They wouldn't speak it to each other.
That's right.
Sure.
Nor would they maybe go out to the marketplace or wherever.
Mm-hmm. Right now I'm reviewing through some of this because, you know, you did mention in this third question about the difference of the AID people living in their own compound, mm-hmm. and I wanted you to basically elaborate on that, which you did. And you'd already pretty much talked about, you know, elaborated on the number four, the forward area, which was good. Mm-hmm. But one thing that comes up very differently is about AID, because you folks, all IVS, no matter what your job skill, you're even the married couple who don't get off and develop their language skill, nonetheless, they're still living mm-hmm. much closer to the people than the AID folks. Mm-hmm. And was there ever any strong difference of opinion over how a project should be done, whether it should be done, because you had an idea based on your village experience that an AID project either wouldn't work completely mm-hmm. or was badly flawed, and you were going to make a lot of suggestions and had to go through discussions with AID folks before you made them realize?
Yeah, no, I think...
if you know what I'm getting at.
I think I know what you're getting at. My work was so much more clearly defined because it was a specific task that we were doing.
Okay.
In agriculture, I think there could have been more that type of a problem.
All right.
But what we were doing is we were going in and replacing a dam where an existing dam was. The only problem was to find out where should we put this new dam.
Okay.
But it had to be in close proximity to where we were before. So the project was more or less defined.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And USAID people gave us great freedom. And we worked together good. It was a give and take. It wasn't, let's do it my way. It was, what's the best way to do this?
Okay.
So it was a really good working relationship we had there. It was partly due to the personalities, I think, but it was also due to the nature of the work. I think in agriculture, where you're dealing with...
Cultural attitudes.
Yeah.
Towards farming and practices.
Type of thing, yeah.
And that's what I was wondering.
Yeah, or what would work best. Now, that's what I found so refreshing about the work that I was in,
uh-huh.
rather than these agriculture or the other economic development type schemes. Yeah, there I think there could have been more problems, but I wasn't in that type of an area, so I don't know exactly what kind of things they did run into. But also I think it was not only myself and USAID that was collaborating, but before these projects were started, we would have the local Lao official. I mean, the one from Luang Prabang, who was the provincial official. He mm-hmm. would be there before the project was started, and the local villages that would benefit from this were all there. So there was a good understanding of what was going to be involved before the project ever got underway.
Was that your method, or was that AID method?
No, that was kind of in force. Yeah, it was in force beforehand, but that was always the goal, was to get the government officials involved, because in some cases the villagers didn't respect the local government officials, so we didn't want to go in there. It wasn't just us doing it, but we're working through the local government. It was to help build them up in esteem also. And we were fortunate there that the man that we were working with was, he was competent,
mm-hmm.
and he was interested in doing what he needed to do. And in a lot of cases, it was only the government. What had they ever done for him? They had nothing, never really done anything to help the local villager out. This was our way of, not only were we there to build and win in friends and influence people, but it was also to support and uphold the local government officials.
And by that you mean the Vientiane officials.
Yeah, or Lawang Prabang.
Or Lawang Prabang, right, yeah, the national officials.
The national officials, that's right.
And how would they get along? How would you describe the reaction or the interaction between the national officials and the local officials?
There was some coolness at times.
Okay, huh.
Because I think there was, we never really saw it openly, but
this. No, you wouldn't know all that.
Yeah, this was a country that was, corruption
mm-hmm.
was at all levels of the government. I mean, it was, there were kickbacks and that type of thing. But all in all, I mean.
Well, how would they relate, you know, government official to government official, you know, would they discuss together, the national official with the local officials? Would they hold meetings and work out problems or, you know, describe the project right along with you folks from both IVS and AID?
I think the officials were only there for the first kind of official kickoff. After that, it was left to us at the local level.
Right.
To get on with the work and do it.
Mm-hmm.
There would be official trips, maybe once a month or so, depending okay. upon the length of it, where the whole string of officials would come out. The USAID people from Vientiane would get with their local counterparts, and they'd come out, and there'd mm-hmm. be a tour of the site and a lunch or whatever at the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So there was some continuous involvement.
Mm-hmm.
But more of a functionary type thing.
Okay. No, I was, I guess, to put it a different way, I was getting at the kind of governmental authority and interaction that's so necessary for a state to become something
mm.
you know, organic and vibrant,
mm-hmm.
rather than just imposed from top on down to bottom, and then the local officials just saying, "Well, yes sir, yes sir," and then
yeah, well,
you
that's,
know.
That was certainly in effect, and I don't think we ever came close to really changing that type of a situation.
Mm-hmm.
But we were intending to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're right. I mean, that's again something that's been in effect in, for. Many, many years, you don't just break down in 1 year or 2 years.
Yeah, I was wondering if this project might have chipped away at some of that.
I think it did. It was certainly a start in the right direction. But
mm-hmm.
that's what would be interesting to see now, would be to go back and see whether what's happening now back there. I don't really have any idea of what the political situation is or whether the government that's in effect is paying attention to the people's needs.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to go back to some of those villages? Would they still be... Would you still know some people?
I don't think so, because their lifespan is so short.
Oh.
That there might be some kids, because we were... You know, kids are always kids, and
mm-hmm.
they would really surround us when we'd go out to the dam site. They'd always want to ride on the Jeep.
Mm-hmm.
And there would probably be some kids that would remember.
Mm-hmm.
I doubt that we would remember them.
Right, yeah. And they might not recognize yourself anymore either, because their
That's
memories
true.
Have faded
yeah.
and, you know,
right.
Physical changes. Now, I didn't know if you might have kept in contact with somebody or had somebody closely that you worked with there
yeah.
who you might still remember. I asked that because, you know, Mark will be going to Vietnam in the winter, and I'm, you know, hoping to go sometime. I don't know when we can do something like that. Let me pause this for a second here.
Yeah.
So
well,
you know that's good. I mean, if someone would try to break in, you've got him there to at least make him aware that there's something around. Let's see, that's the first tape, I sure hope. Anyway, toward the end of this survey, we asked, how the experience affected you. And I'll ask it again, how did it affect you?
It affected me, I'd say, in every aspect of my life, and certainly in my religious life it affected me. As you'd see these monks, there are, of course, Buddhists there, and every morning, the Buddhists were expected to spend 1 year as a monk in a monastery.
Uh-huh.
And that means they give up the only clothes they have are the orange robes that they have on their back, and they would go out once a day with a bowl in their hand, and they had to depend on the villagers giving them enough rice for that day to live. And that's all they had. And I remember thinking, you know, what if I would have been born in Laos? I would probably be a monk out there, going around in my orange robes, asking for the enough to eat for the day.
For at least 1 year, anyway.
Yeah. Right, and I began to think about myself, you know, okay, the only reason I'm a Christian is because I was happened to be born where I was born, to the parents that I was. And you begin to think, you begin to question your own faith, you know, is that the only way? Can't there be another way? Why could anybody be condemned for where they were born? These people had no choice about that. So it did cause me to think about my own religion. I think, if anything, it probably deepened my faith in the end. But it deepened because it made me question. Here I saw firsthand people that were really deeply religious, that believed the way they did. the other aspect that we had, too, there were some missionaries there. There was a Catholic man there that he lived among the Highland people primarily, but he carried nothing but the clothes on his back, and he would go from village to village, spend as much time as he wanted before he'd go off to another one. And then we had some Christian Missionary Alliance people there that that were living in Luang Prabang with the people that I knew. But they were living in pretty nice houses. But they would go out and work in the surrounding communities. And what they were fighting against was, number one, the Buddhist faith, and then they also had a spirit worship type thing. And it was interesting to see. They had a certain group of people that were attending and all that. But yet I think these people held on to all three religions. That they still, it was tough for them to give up their spirit worship. It was tough because all their friends were Buddhists too. So, yeah, there was a religious missionary effort there, but I often wondered, you know, just what of a lasting effect that had. How did it change me in other ways? I think it certainly broadened my horizons. Until you live in another culture, I don't think you can begin to realize what a good life we have here in the United States. I think it makes you more tolerant of other people. I think for a while I was more patient because it takes a long time to get things done. These are people that they're hard workers, but there's nothing for them to do, nowhere to go. So things don't have to be done right then. You do them in your own good time. I'm sure it changed me in ways that a person would have never believed. Subtle ways here and there. I don't think there's no way you can live as close to another culture and immersed in their culture like we were for 2 years, 2.5 years, and not be changed in probably every aspect of your life. But I think a lot of me don't really realize it. And the changes, some of them are for the good, but then you come back here and now you're caught up in the in the rat race of get ahead. Get ahead and work from morning till night, keeping up with the Joneses.
Mm-hmm.
You lose track, I think, of some of the basic values in life. But I think you have to go back on a periodic basis, get away from everything in order to do that. And there again, that's one of the things, you know, you...
A kind of retreat.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
In a sense.
Yeah, right. Prolonged retreat.
Mm-hmm.
So that you can totally transform yourself. Yeah.
Get some perspective.
That's right. Did you find that same thing, kind of?
Very much. Yeah. Yeah. In terms of how frugally I live, and that doesn't mean just how much money I spend.
Mm-hmm.
But that means making sure I don't throw anything away.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, saving that aluminum foil.
Yeah,
what a waste to throw away aluminum foil with this this is my opinion now, but, you know.
That's right. And
you know, little things like that, you know, yeah. Using water just like as if it's water.
Yeah, well, and I remember we'd, over there you'd maybe go in and get some cookies. What would they use to wrap up your cookies? Would be a 2-year-old Los Angeles Times newspaper, a piece of newsprint. They'd fold mm-hmm. it up and
stuff. Not fancy packaging and garbage like that. Yeah, and just recognizing that, you know, I can make do with something. I can keep something and then make something out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think some of our parents who went through the Depression learned, too. Mm-hmm. Whereas mm-hmm. we would have been born and raised more in the 50s when
mm-hmm.
everyone thought, well, we're so wealthy.
Yeah, right.
We're so powerful. We'll just spend it.
I think an experience like that makes you more innovative too, because you're now you don't have access to the local hardware store. If you need something, you need to fix something. Something needs a problem needs solved. You have to use the materials at hand, so you become much more innovative.
Or you also find that you really don't have to have it anyway.
That's true. You're in. Why be innovative? You don't need it. True.
The Catholic priest that you mentioned, who was he? Do you remember?
Don't have a clue as to what his name was.
Okay.
I think I met him once, but that's mm-hmm. what he did. He just went, he lived among the people, and I thought, you know, if you're going to be a missionary, this is the way to do it.
Yeah.
And I think he probably had a much better rapport with the people than the people that would live in a nice house in the town and just go out on a date. The same thing that the USAID people would have when they were living in their compound and
mm-hmm.
and staying in the USAID compound dealing with the people. They really didn't get a feel for the people. But this Catholic priest, he really got to know the people. He could speak the language very well because there was nowhere to speak anything else.
Yeah. I only asked about him because when I was at Bill Taylor's house last night, he mentioned a Catholic priest who would go off and with only the shirt on his back
mm-hmm.
and live with people and knew the language so well. And he mentioned, do you remember what order this priest might have been?
No, I don't.
Okay. Bill Taylor said that he was Oblate Father.
Mm-hmm.
And that his first name was Luke. And that's what Taylor named his son.
Oh, is that right?
Talk about an impression and bringing something back. What about the Catholic, or not Catholic, excuse me, the Protestant couple? Did you knew of them and stuff? Did you?
Yeah, we socialized.
Within the American community, socializing.
Yeah, sure. I mean, and they would be at the functions, too. They would get invited to the functions at the palace whenever there was something wedding and that. I mean, they all the foreigners were invited to something like that.
But that socializing is formal function.
I mean, function.
Yeah, you wouldn't hang out with them and drop in for a drink or something like that.
No, definitely. No, they were only when you were invited for a social function.
Okay.
That's right. And they were very few. The only mm-hmm. one that I really remember was the wedding of the princess. I think there was another occasion, like when we changed ambassadors, perhaps.
Okay.
And he came up there, and there again, it was that type of a function.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, I didn't know if you might have been gotten close to them, if only out of, you know, desire for, you know, someone from a common cultural background, or, you know, just to sit around and chat for a while. Were there any, like, American Special Forces folks in the area that you could have socialized with at all?
Air America pilots, yeah. They were,
oh, that's right. They were, sure, yeah, they would have been.
They were a unique type of people. And at the Vientiane airport, there was a restaurant. And we were able to eat in this restaurant. They served American food because the presence was there.
Right.
But as you'd hang out with these, we didn't hang out with the pilots, but out at the airport, you'd occasionally run into these people that you would ask them. Everyone was either with IVS or USAID, or you were mm-hmm. an Air America pilot. Occasionally, one of these guys would say he was with USAID. Oh, well, what department are you with? Well, I'm with Rural Development. Oh, you know Earl Rambo then, or this other guy. No, never heard of him. And here, these were guys that we found out later, they would hang, they, they lived across the river in Thailand, but they would come over into Laos during the daytime. And it didn't take much to figure out who they really were.
What do you mean?
They were CIA.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
Intelligence gatherers.
Oh, man. And not knowing the local AID officials for their cover. Not very good.
Not very good.
Not very awe-inspiring.
No.
Oh, God. Yeah. Well, they probably weren't really too much fun to hang out with.
No, we had nothing much in common with them.
Yeah.
Dear America pilots were, they were a breed apart. I mean, they were good pilots. So they knew what they were doing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I think we've covered actually a fairly good amount of stuff here. And I can't think of anything else offhand. And it's, you know, we started around 8 and it's 9:35.
Perfect.
Yeah, so it's not quite an hour and a half on the tape, but it's getting on there. So I'm going to turn it off.
Fine.
And thank you much.
You're welcome.
And